right, Cal. It's great to be talking again. And we were getting really fired up in the last fireside chat about the real promise of being able to think more effectively, focus more deeply, and do things with your mind that maybe you didn't think were possible. And so I was hoping in this conversation that we could dive a little bit into the sort of high-level cognitive tasks that you do, in particular in your computer science research and also in writing books, and see if we can't sort of tease out some ideas for what actually goes on in your thinking processes that maybe someone in a different field or profession or even pursuing different types of deep hobbies could use to approach.
Yeah, I think it's a good topic because it's something we, and I mean we in the cultural sense here, not just you and I, it's something that we don't talk enough about, which is what really goes into the organization and execution of long-term intellectually demanding projects. So people like professors or writers, they build up these heuristics and approaches and strategies for how they actually organize their work, and they really matter. But that doesn't always filter down when people are first learning about depth and focused mind style activities. And then people end up perhaps with a much simpler notion of, well, you know, once I've decided what to do, it's just a matter of like, I got to make sure I put in a couple hours or get my time in or something like that. And it misses the rich structure that often supports really high level intellectual work. So I agree, this is a good topic. And it's one I've been working on recently. I just updated today my strategic plan for publications, computer science publications for the fall. So I finished that pretty recently before our call. So I've been thinking a lot about what's my strategy for the fall. So I think that timing is good to get in these type of details.
Well, and one other thing that I wanted to add before we get into the weeds here is that I feel like in a kind of earlier era, there were a lot more apprenticeships. There was a lot more, you sit at the feet of the master and they strike the, you know, the hammer against the anvil and smithing something out of metal. And that's how you see how someone does that. And I think this is how we are hardwired to learn a lot of things, is through this sort of watching how someone does it. And this isn't to discount education. I know, you know, you have a PhD, you work in academia. I'm clearly a fan of learning things via courses and things like that. But I think sometimes what can be missed is that when you abstract and remove some of these cognitive skills outside of their sort of professional practice, it can be hard for an outsider to figure out how does someone actually do it. It can be hard to sort of be like, oh, well, what is it that someone who is in, you know, top performer in the world of writing, what are they doing when they actually sit down to write? And I think this is very interesting because I have had this sort of privileged point where, at least in my own kind of professional space of like writing and entrepreneurship, gotten a chance to see some of the best people at work and talk to them about like the kind of seemingly mundane details about how they work. And it's often fascinating. It's fascinating how most people aren't really aware of what the protocol or processes or thinking strategies go into that level of work. And so I think this will be really exciting to kind of get a little bit more technical and talk about kind of what you actually do in some of the things that you do. And then maybe we can reflect on that a little bit. So if you want to kick it off, why don't we talk a little bit about, let's start with your computer science work, because I think, you know, certainly I feel like this is, you know, a very difficult task to do like high level kind of basically mathematics work at a high level. So I'm very curious as to what is your sort of process for thinking about creating new knowledge?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that you do learn through implied apprenticeships. It's one of the big things you learn in graduate school, and this is not in any class you take in graduate school. It's nothing that's actually tested on any qualifier, but you observe how your advisor organizes his or her work, how you know they approach paper writing, how your colleagues approach it, and you pick up these skills. And one of the things I've argued just more generally is that one of the reasons why really top grad programs produce people who also become top, it's not entirely a function of selection. It's not just that biologists who get into MIT are better biologists than those that don't go to MIT. Part of what happens is when you go to a place like MIT, you're surrounded by professors who only publish big papers. Like, that's their standard. I want to publish papers in science. I want to publish papers in nature, right? And so you get close up, oh, here's what's involved to actually do that. And man, it might be harder than you think and rigorous and obsessive in a way that you might not have naturally been. But if you're training under someone who writes papers for nature and writes papers for science, then when you become an academic, you write papers for nature and science. And if you didn't, even if you have equal talent, it's very difficult to do that because you haven't seen what's really involved. And so I like these type of exercises because I think there's a lot of implicit learning about how people in academia, how they produce their work, that makes a big difference about what's possible. So in my world, for example, I do theory. So my papers are theorems. They're typically on problems either I invented or other people invented and I like, but the whole thing is very abstract. I don't really touch a computer except for to write up my results. And how I go about it is, you know, I read and talk to people a lot. Conferences are important. And why are they important? Because I just talk to my peers and I talk to my collaborators and I'll have Zoom calls with them. We talk a lot and we read a lot. And we find something, and people visit campus, right? I really want to emphasize the role of conversation in identifying research problems. And the sheer number of hours involved in sifting through possible problems to find a good one. And so we have a lot of visitors on campus. That's common. People will be in town from Europe or Asia, and they'll come and we'll spend the day on campus, and we'll sit at the whiteboard and we'll just walk and talk and think. Out of this will fall problems. You have a problem that you think like, okay, this is something that seems reasonable. And then typically the goal is I'm going to work on this problem till we can get something published. And then we'll see if that thing has legs. And if it doesn't, at least we got a publication out of it. And if it does have legs, if it wins some awards or gets some momentum going, then we can now publish a lot more papers on this topic, right? So like once we've settled on a topic, we're going to see it through to a publication. And then we'll see where to go from there. And I'll get into the nitty gritty. I can get into that in more detail later. But basically, then work on the problem is, I don't know, imagine a castle. And you're attacking. Let's try this attack. Oh, we got repulsed there. Let's try this attack this time. It's like coming back again and again and again. What about this angle? What about that? What if we bring in a trebuchet? Did that work? No. Okay, maybe we'll try a siege tower. Like, it's constantly coming at the problem from different angles. Typically you end up having to modify or simplify the problem or find some way in, like, well, if I really drastically simplify the problem just to this thing, it kind of forces the issue of like, okay, in this case, we can make some progress. Is that generalized? No. Okay. So that tunnel we were digging to the castle fell in. What if we try this? And so it is like this constant attack from all different angles until you finally find something that gets you through one of the castle walls. And then you have a little bit of progress. Then you have to kind of keep repeating these attacks, and it usually takes 6 months to a year to sometimes a year and a half until you finally really broken through and have something, some sort of meaningful progress on your siege, and then you turn around and say, how do we write this up? So that's the high-level view of what theory research looks like.
So one of the points that I want to emphasize right now, and I think it's very interesting because it somewhat goes against maybe the stereotype that people have of Cal Newport. And this actually goes to, I was reading this book, some sort of like memoir by Hamming, and he was, engineer, very famous, did a lot of stuff on like compression and stuff like this. And he was talking about how in a seemingly antithesis of deep work, how his feeling was that, you know, people who worked in the closed doors sometimes end up working on the wrong problems, and that people who work in the kind of open environment, so they're always talking to their colleagues, they maybe get less done, but they're sort of more aware of what's important and what needs to be worked on. And so I found this very interesting because the deep work kind of methodology often sort of suggests this kind of removing yourself from society. And so it was very interesting to me how much you emphasize the kind of social aspect of conversation in the process of figuring out which problems to solve. So maybe you could elaborate a bit on that, because certainly I think, you know, I feel the same way, not obviously with creating computer science theorems, but even just with writing books and stuff or doing business improvements, my network and having conversations with colleagues is so essential, because otherwise if you get totally disconnected from that, it's very easy to spend lots and lots of time working on a problem that you've just totally invented and turns out not to be very important or no one cares about or that kind of thing.
Well, a lot of people ask me about that Hamming speech. I mean, it was actually a speech he gave called You and Your Research. that is basically the premise of the speech, which I think is really cool, is how do you do Nobel caliber research? Because he was surrounded by multiple people who won the Nobel Prize at Bell Labs. And so he gave this really cool speech. And that was one of his pieces of advice, was leave your door open. Now, people will often come to me and interpret that literally. Like, oh, like when you're at all points when you're working, you should have your door open and I guess invite distraction. Now, he meant this, of course, more metaphorically, as you were just elaborating there. You need to talk to and expose yourself to lots of different people and lots of different ideas, especially if you're doing peer research, because this was the whole idea of the Bell Labs Murray Hill headquarters where he worked, is that they built one big building, which is really unusual because this was essentially a university style campus. And most universities say, great, there is the math building and there is the biology building and there is the physics building. And Bell Labs did something unique. They said, what if we put those all in one giant building? And they all had the same cafeteria. And it's connected with one really long hallway. Well, that's because they wanted, like what Hamming was talking about, that you, the physicists would talk to the biologists, would talk to the computer scientists, would talk to the mathematicians. And then you're going to find cool problems and cool techniques. And it generated a lot of Nobel Prizes. And it worked pretty well. And so I think that's a great idea. And it's one I'm always trying to do, is I'm always trying to, in conversation, talking to people, learning techniques, exposing myself to techniques. I should do it probably more, but I think it's really good practice. Now, of course, to generalize from that to, oh, when you're actually working deeply on a specific problem in a specific moment, you shouldn't have your door closed. Well, that's a non-proper interpretation, I think, of what Hamming was trying to say. I think there was plenty of times when he was working on coding theory, et cetera, that, you know, him and his collaborators were happy to sequester themselves. But I think it's a really great, point. And then the other thing I want to mention here, and I talked about this motivated by Bell Labs as well in my book, Deep Work, is what I call the whiteboard effect, which is if you're working on a hard problem with collaborators in real time, so they're there with you or you're together on Zoom working on it, you will reach deeper levels of depth than if you work on it alone. So there's nothing about deep work that says being solitary is better than being with people. In fact, being with other people working at the same whiteboard, hence the name whiteboard effect, actually pushes you to go deeper. And there's a couple of reasons for it, but one is just the social pressure. If you let your attention wander, you have to stop the conversation and have them roll it back. And there's a social cost to that. So you don't get as distracted. You concentrate. Also, you have fresh angles on the problem. So where you might get stuck, someone else can keep it moving forward. So like two or three people at a whiteboard is going to produce more depth out of your brain than if it's just you alone at your whiteboard. And so there's nothing about intense, deep efforts that says you should be solitary. And so these are two good things to separate. You don't want to be distracted. You don't want, more specifically, to be context switching, you know, changing your focus of attention from what you're working on to something else to back to what you're working on. That's really bad. But to be working on the same thing with other people, that's good. Or when you're not doing deep work, to be surrounded by a lot of interesting people so you get exposed to lots of ideas and techniques, that's also really good. So, I mean, I think that's a good angle you talk about. And I know, Scott, like in your own life, when you think about your own projects, your courses and your books, it seems like you've simulated a lot of the Bell Lab setup because there's various people that you know and you talk to. There's even places you have gone before. I've noticed that because, you know, you're not actually on a campus, you're running your own business, that you've kind of gone out of your way to make sure that, like, you're constantly being exposed and talking to other people in the field.
Well, you have to. And I think this is also sort of related to, I know we're kind of going deep into this tangent, which I love that you had this sort of whole discussion on having kind of already in the sleeve when I brought it up. This was not pre-scripted to anyone who's listening to this. Cal just happened to know this when I was just brought that up off the top of my head. And I think for myself, when I'm working on ideas and stuff, I know when there's places I need to be having conversations with people. And I think that there is a kind of deep conversation that you can have with someone about an idea that is different from, let's say, you know, the kind of interactions that are typical of like Twitter or something like that, where you are having a little bit less deep engagement. And so for me, one of the big practices that was always essential for me was setting aside time to just regularly have like a call with people. Now, I mean, admittedly, my schedule has made it, it's more effortful now to do this in a way that it wasn't when I was, you know, 23 or something like this. But having, you know, a 60 minute or 90 minute call where you end up talking about some sort of either an idea that you might write about or an idea that's affecting your business or something like this with a friend. And I often find like that's where a lot of the key breakthroughs come through. And so definitely I concur with the idea that if you view sort of depth as being only just sort of working on your own, you might be missing out on some key insights.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, you know, techniques, ideas, approaches. Now it should be worth saying, reading can actually simulate some of that same effect. So reading broadly, you know, reading books, reading articles, just being exposed to other people's ideas and techniques and approaches, you actually get a lot of that same benefit. It's why, you know, if I'm working on a book or I'm working on an article, I read quite broadly because you're essentially in conversation with those authors. You're not actually in a cafeteria at Bell Labs, you know, talking to them over food, but you are learning, oh, this is an interesting way to think about it. And this guy tackles projects this way, and this guy has this philosophy about the world. And so I don't know if you do this too, Scott, but I often think about my reading as lots of serendipitous conversations with smart people. You're building up that toolkit of ways of seeing the world, ideas, strategies, frameworks, right? And everything you end up doing is going to draw from that toolkit. And so, you know, if you can't necessarily be talking to a lot of people, or you're new to a field, you're like, I can't just call people, they don't know me, you can have literary conversations. And I think a book will get you there, articles get you there.
And I think one of the things that I've definitely noticed is sort of an evolution of the books that I tend to read, and I would highly recommend to anyone listening here, is to push yourself to read harder books that seem to be less practical. I remember when I started out and I was really keen on like reading a lot of productivity, self-improvement type books, things in the business section. And admittedly, you know, my book, if you're able to find it in a bookstore, will be in the business section. Many of Cal's books are similarly there. So we're not trying to disparage the very work that we're writing. But I think there's something different about reading, let's say, a 500-page book written by a serious academic who's making a serious argument very often, written to sort of contrast his or her intellectual opponents who also know a great deal about that subject, that this gives you sort of deeper insights and intellectual tools that I think a book which is kind of written as a sort of summary of for a lay audience, often with like kind of like, what's the point? What's the practical outcome of this? I feel like, yes, sometimes you, if you're just sort of weighing it on, well, what's the most useful advice I get? Those kind of self-improvement books are often a little bit better for getting that kind of advice. But in terms of the serendipity quality, in terms of the, oh, this is a way of thinking about a problem that I hadn't thought about before, and how could that apply to something that I care about or some my work, that's often a lot deeper. And so for me, I read lots of books on subjects that have nothing to do with the things I'm writing about. And I find that it's surprising how often they work their way into my writing or my thinking or how I deal with various kinds of problems. So like in the recent past, I've read a big book by David Wooten on the history of science. And I also read a book about fungus, which, it's the kind of thing that like, well, why read a book about fungus? That's not going to improve your life. But it's a new intellectual domain that gives you tools so that when you're thinking about it, you're like, oh, wow, this is actually kind of, there's some analogies here, or there's some ways of thinking about problems. And having to kind of come face to face with sort of a serious intellectual thinker who's kind of really working the gears to create an argument, I think it also ups your own game for what you expect out of yourself intellectually and thinking about things and forming strategies and whatnot.
Yeah, it's one of the best things you can do. I mean, today I was reading this book, and I don't know if I'm going to get the name right, but I think it's called Masters of the Planet. Mm. And it's about early humans and what we know about them. So it was written by at the time, the curator of the National Museum of History. And it's, here is the cutting edge science on what we know about the early humans and the origin of Homo sapiens and how we know it and what the debates are and the arguments in the field. And I got to say, it's really useful. I mean, A, it's interesting. it's refining my mental frame for understanding sort of the early human evolution, but it's also giving me vocabulary and ways of thinking about parts of human behavior that's going to sift into my writing I do in the future, like a much more careful treatment about things like symbolic thinking and when that arose and how we know it arose and how you can look at tool construction and what tool construction tells us about what's happening in the brain and the debates that happened about the right way to do speciation for humans. You know, I don't know when I'm going to directly use all this, but I do know I have a more complex frame about that now. I know now that if I try to deal with like Paleolithic explanations for behaviors, I'm going to be able to approach that with a subtly improved level of sophistication because I've just seen the way and the nuance with which the experts of the Paleolithic talk about it. Just like you're saying with, you know, talking about the history of science or talking about fungus, that's going to be really, probably really useful. So if you multiply that by what you're reading all the time, it's going to have a big effect. Now, in this case, this is for an article. I'm working on an article for a big magazine. And when I'm working on these long, long form articles for big magazines, just to give some more insight, there is months early on, like what's happening now, where I just read lots of things. And some things I read in detail, like this Masters of the Planet, and some things I skim, but it'll probably be 6 or 7 books and 4 or 5 interviews before I feel that, okay, I see an angle that I can maybe coherently outline and talk to my editor about.
This is really interesting. And so I want to go a little bit deeper on this point because I think that this brings out something that I've noticed, which is that, again, like if you're looking at from the strict cost benefit analysis of like, what's the point in reading? Again, I'm using my example of a book on fungus. I was talking about this with a friend and he was laughing when I mentioned I was reading a book on fungus, like kind of like, why would you read a book on fungus? And I think the reason and the sort of point I'm making right now is that if you just look at it strictly from like, well, what are the going to be the practical tips that I get out of reading book X, then a book on fungus is probably not going to be near the top of the list unless you happen to be like a truffle hunter or something like this. Yet what I feel is that what these books do is they kind of create the frame that you have for thinking about reality. And the richer and more detailed that is, often what happens is that when you're reading the book, you're kind of just sort of, okay, let me see if I can just understand what happened in the history of science. And, you know, you're reading these detailed accounts of Galileo and Newton and, you know, all these ups and downs and, you know, whether this person's opinion on this was correct. And it can sometimes feel like, okay, well, you know, but how does this practically connect to my life? It doesn't at all. I can't see it. I can't see that picture. But if you regularly engage in this practice, now, when I think about anything related to science, I have such a stronger foundation of that. When I think about anything related to innovation or coming up with ideas, I have such a strong and richly set of analogies and background to come up with that, that when I'm approaching some of these other topics, it's just a lot easier to reason from it because your model of reality is stronger. And so I think there is a real advantage, I think, especially once you've soaked up kind of the easy practical tips of a field or of a profession, to getting this kind of strong foundation of knowledge in not only the areas related to your industry or to your core hobbies, but to broader areas, you know, physics, biology, history, anthropology, these kinds of topics. And the more you have kind of a more accurate picture of reality in many ways, this leads to a lot of innovations, or this leads to you being able to make sense of a lot of arguments and practical advice in other areas. So I think this idea of kind of making sure that the ground is very fertile before you try to plant seeds to grow large trees is very important intellectually. And I think that it contributes a lot to your actual productivity when it comes to doing things like writing or research or really any kind of intellectual skill. The larger the base you have to draw upon, the more fertile you're going to have for ground for creativity and productivity.
Yeah, and it makes you smarter. I mean, just the act of trying to read these things stretches your brain and gets it more comfortable with not just concentration, but if we look under the covers of concentration, more comfortable with building up complex mental structures, moving information between structures, building up complex schemas, categorizing information that you encounter in your short-term memory into long-term schemas. All this is the building blocks of intellectual contribution, and it takes practice. And so, you know, there's a reason why, you know, university education was always built around book reading. that's practice. Just like if you're going to be in an athletic endeavor, you better be spending a lot of time outside of the actual competition doing calisthenics, doing, you know, weight training or whatever. This also plays that role. Stepping back to the original, we got here when I was talking a little bit about my attack on academic papers and mentioned a little bit my attack on how I write articles. There is a more general point there I want to underscore for the listeners, because I think it's really important. It's that, okay, so you're reading lots of things, for example, but this is not necessarily directly making linear progress on something you care about. So you have to be comfortable with that. And what I was also trying to emphasize with my castle analogy is even when you're trying to directly make progress on a hard intellectual endeavor, you have to be comfortable with thinking about failed attacks as productive, right? That it's not a linear path. I think it's really hard for people who are new to constructing things with their brain, because it's a little bit different than constructing things with their hands. It's not a linear path. I spent 2 hours today. I have 2 hours more progress. I could see it. You know, this part of the statue got carved. It's not like that. Actually, the bulk of the progress, when you're trying to crack something, right? How do I write this? What do I want to write? How do I solve this proof? It's a lot of failed attacks, and you have to see that as productive. Like, okay, I'm reading this and talking to this person, and maybe there's an angle here that's going to break open this article or this book chapter. And you're like, nah, I can't quite use it. But that was productive. You have to do that 10 times to get the one time that works. Or, you know, I was trying to solve this math proof, and I spent all day thinking about this, and I just got stuck. I didn't get anywhere. Not a waste of time. It's necessary. You need 9 of those before you get to the 10th where you're going to make progress. So that's the other point that I want to underscore here, is cognitive work is not necessarily linear in terms of the return you get on investment. And so you have to be very comfortable with activities that in the short term do not show you obvious return, because it's building up knowledge. It's building up more sophisticated mental models. It's building up what doesn't work. It's exposing you to new information. All that is productive. You just don't necessarily see a linear return all the time on those activities.
So this is something that I think is a very interesting idea, because it can lead to a bit of a paradox for productivity, which is that we have a somewhat metric obsessed this idea that you want to be checking off tasks on the to-do list model for a lot of productivity. And it's sort of an obvious model, because the contrasting view where you don't measure anything or you don't ever have any kind of metrics or checking things off is often not like this sort of bastion of creativity, but often things where you're just slacking off. You're not actually getting anything done. And so there's this sort of weird zone that you have to occupy where you are doing a lot of things that are hard. So they kind of engender a certain level of effort and strain, and they're not going to be the kind of thing that you just sort of like, okay, yeah, I'm just gonna, oh, looks like I read this, you know, 600 page tome just by accident, because yeah. I guess I just lost track of time and I was on page, you know, 750 of this esoteric argument. No, you're gonna have to put in effort into it. And that's true, you know, even if you're not doing anything like research wise, even if you were doing something where you're, you know, it's a lot of hands-on work where you're just really frustrated. So if you're a programmer and you're working on a difficult problem and you're trying like 15 different ways of doing it and it's failure, 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 failure. This isn't going to be something that you're just going to fall into doing. You're going to probably say to yourself, maybe I'll just choose an easier problem. And so I think the challenge here is that because these things don't actually in the short term contribute to progress, and they can often feel like you're not doing it well, there can be this sort of tendency, if you get more obsessed about productivity, to sometimes try to eliminate these things, to try to emphasize these kind of, you can quickly get a small win or quickly check something off. And so I think that's what I like about this sort of deep work philosophy or this idea of concentration, is because it's clear that that kind of cognitive work matters. And if you just try to turn it into a set of tasks that you can very easily and quickly accomplish, you sometimes manage to neatly brush aside all the like really important work that you need to be doing that is amorphous and vague and hard to actually make progress in.
Yeah, I had this conversation that was relevant to this. Earlier in the fall when we were recording this, I had my friend Ryan Holiday, the author, on my podcast. And one of the things I asked him was, why are there not more young writers And what I was thinking about is like, look, there's this whole group of writers and we all came up together. You're in that group and Ryan's in that group and James Clear is in that group and et cetera. And sort of like at the older end of the group is Tim Ferriss. He kind of started it. And then the younger end of the group, I guess, I don't know, maybe you're towards the younger end of it, Orion. Right. So there's this group of writers that all were started writing in their 20s. You know, they started publishing in their 20s and nonfiction and all became pretty well-known best-selling writers. And now it's a pretty influential group in the world of publishing. You know, there's a lot of books being sold there. And I was asking Ryan, I was like, okay, now that, you know, I started writing in my 20s, I'm in my late 30s now, where are the 20-year-olds today that are now coming up and getting their first books out? I don't see them. I'm looking for them. I don't see them. And one of the things he said is like, oh, they're podcasting. And when he went a little deeper into it, he's like, and one of the reasons why they're podcasting is because you can get immediate results. Like podcasting gives you a much more immediate, like I'm just kind of an interesting person and I can record something and publish it this day. And then people might listen to it and the podcast might grow. And it doesn't require this long, slow burn of like reading and learning and crafting a book. And it's not very good. Then you write your second book. He's like, there's just no patience for that. And so that is like the equivalent, right? Like the cognitive equivalent of checking things off your to-do list to some degree. I mean, it's ironic we're talking about this on a podcast and that I talked to Ryan about this on a podcast, but I feel like we've done the foundational work. But I think that's a great underscoring of that tendency of like, well, isn't there something like I want to crush it, right? Like, can I, like, I get my podcast episodes out. Let me get the tech right. Let me get 3 episodes out a week. Like I can focus on that and see something right away. Let me get my social media thing going. Let me get my, make sure my posting game is on. Like you want things you can do. People are always really quick to hire, you know, young writers. They'll be really quick to hire like staffs and like, you really need to build out a company. Like you're just writing books, but you know, they're like, we gotta have a team. Like people like action because it's just much less stressful and anxiety producing than like, I'm going back to the woodshed and I'm not sure what's going to come out of it. But the one thing I'll say is that, you know, of the various advice I've given, when you talk to academics and you talk to like fiction writers, the one piece of advice I've given, a very simple heuristic that's probably most popular is the notion of a deep work tally, where you just write down at the end of every day, here is how many hours of deep work I did. And the reason why I think that is so popular among creative types is because to some extent, that's about as good as you can track it. Like the best you can do during some periods is just like, I'm stretching my brain and I'm working. And I don't know. I read a bunch of things. I don't know if it'll be relevant. I talked to some people. I don't know if it'll be relevant. I spent all day on a proof. This proof might never actually be solved. But if I'm putting in hours day after day, week after week, I know progress will come. And so I always found that interesting that simple idea was one of the most impactful that I hear, especially back from creative people. And I think that's why is that for those type of endeavors, if you consistently put in the time and you push yourself and stretch yourself and work on the right type of things, you will make progress, but you won't make progress every time you put in the time.
I think one of the things that makes this possible though is having a strong conviction about which kinds of activities are the right kinds of activities to be putting in. So to like use the example, there's the kind of working out at the gym and the kind of good pain of like muscular growth that, okay, I'm straining my muscles properly. And there is the, oh no, I've pulled that. Now I'm going to be injured for the next 3 weeks. And the problem is that when you're new to these kinds of efforts, it's harder to tell maybe whether you're overexerting your muscles or whether you're exerting them correctly to get strength gains. And so I think cognitively speaking as well, it can be hard to know, is this the good kind of frustrating where I'm making a lot of attacks towards the right kind of problem? And yes, maybe these vantage points didn't fail, but I've now learned things about the problem so I can approach it in a different way and kind of repeat this process. And eventually I will get some kind of important work product out of it. But then there's also the times where you've just picked the wrong kind of problem, or you've kind of started from a faulty premise or foundation that, you know, I think, you know, you've also been critical before of things like, you know, National Novel Write Month or things like this, where you're kind of starting from the wrong premises. And the premises is that, like, the hard thing about, you know, being successful in writing fiction is just churning out a book very quickly, that it's more about, okay, no, you have to have this kind of training to produce something of that caliber. And so I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how do you distinguish between the good pain and the bad pain in this kind of strong cognitive effort? And how do you sort of align yourself so that, yes, okay, I know with some faith that if I continue down this path, even if there's going to be 99 failed attempts, it'll all be worth it when I get the 100th one successful, versus, you know, you just picked the wrong kind of project to work on, and that this pain is just sort of like, okay, no, you need to actually do something different, and you need to be working on different kinds of tasks. Yeah. How do you approach this kind of ambiguity that I think a lot of people feel, and I think it prevents them from engaging in that kind of effort?
Well, it's a crucial point. It's a crucial point. And so I think there's two elements to it. The first is the project you're working on has to be realistic for your situation. So first, and this takes some effort, you got to make sure that, okay, the thing I'm working on, it is realistic for me to actually make progress on and solve this. I have the right resources. I have the right information. I have the right training. I have the right access, whatever it is. It is a realistic thing. It's a stretch, but it's a realistic thing for me with my current resources and situation and abilities to actually accomplish. Now, our tendency is to jump past that. Our tendency is to jump past to the really big goal because it seems more exciting, but it might not actually be realistic. So you have to first make sure that you've chosen something to go after that is realistic for you to make progress on. And then you need to apprentice. And by apprentice, I mean, you got to be surrounded by people who know how that world works. You need to see how they work. You need feedback from them about how you're going to work. You need to build up your confidence that these are the types of efforts that ultimately are going to make progress. It's like I learned as a grad student at the MIT theory group, oh, here's what it looks like to try to solve a theory problem. You know, first of all, I knew I had the training because I had trained there and it was very clear. I know this skill. I know that skill. I was training under this person. This person's very good. And then I could watch people who were working on these type of problems say, oh, I see how this works. They stare at the whiteboard. They come at it a bunch of times. You get involved with papers early on. I'll just do this one small section, but maybe I can be involved, right? So you train, you apprentice. Both those things are crucial. And if you skip one of those two things, and I think it's so important you brought this up, yeah, you are going to be in trouble. So like, let's say you want to be like a magazine writer. You know, you just think like that looks so cool. That's great. That's a great goal. Magazine writing is great. But if you're new to it, you wouldn't say, okay, well, my goal is I want something in the New Yorker. So let me work on a New Yorker article. It's like, well, wait a second. Do you have like the experience, the connections? Have you proven yourself? Do you know how that works? Like, is there any reasonable way that like the project you're working on this month can end up in a New Yorker article? If you're new to writing, the answer is probably no. So what you need to do instead, like I did when I was early in my writing career, is say, what's a place where I realistically could publish given like I'm new or my skills are here, et cetera. All right. I really believe that's a place I could publish, right? Or similarly, instead of doing National Novel Writing Month, like I'm just going to write a great novel and sell it to, you know, HarperCollins or something like that. You might say, well, maybe I want to start with like short story fiction for this online magazine. And okay, that's more tractable. You know, that's something people relatively new, if you really get something good, can get it in. And that makes more sense, right? And then you try to surround yourself by people who are doing it. So I'm trying to publish for these magazines, be it fiction or nonfiction. Let me hang out with some other writers who are trying to do the same thing. Let me see how they write. Let me talk to people who maybe regularly publish there, figure out their strategy, sort of learn what does it look like? What does the running up to the castle wall and bouncing off again, what does that look like in my field? Which is all to say, you're absolutely right that you need confidence that this is a tractable problem and I'm doing the right types of things to make progress on this problem. And without that, you're just running on slogans and hope. And I don't think that's very sustainable. I also think it's a waste of energy because it's just a crapshoot whether or not that's going to produce anything.
So I think this is probably a good point to leave it. We've talked about a lot of ideas today. We talked about the importance of conversations and talking to other people in deciding not only what problems you should be working on, but what's the right way to work on them. And we talked about the ideas of straining yourself on harder tasks in order to make progress. And so I think this is a very interesting month. We're kind of getting, now that we've sort of had the kind of introductory conversations in months one and two, we're getting really into the weeds of talking about some of these often neglected factors. Is there anything else you'd like to leave off with today, Cal, before we rejoin next week?
Well, basically, you can think of that my goal in months one and two is to convince you to stop using social media as much. And my goal in part three will be to convince you not to do National Novel Writers Month. So there you see, those are the two things I love to rail on. So be wary of more, what is it, NWM or what, however the abbreviation goes. That's one of my favorite hobby horses. The only thing I dislike almost as much is social media. So be prepared for that.
All right. Well, on that note, I will talk to you next week, Cal.
See you next week.